All rise, please. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Idaho is now in session for school to law.
Thank you very much. Musical chairs up here at the bench. Please be safe. Good morning again and welcome for our third case of the day on September 17, 2025, here in this beautiful new courthouse in Coeur d'Alene. We're very pleased to be here and to hear the third case, which is McLaughlin versus Moore, case number 51858. The appellant cross-respondents are Patrick and Megan McLaughlin, represented by Christopher J. Curley, and the respondent cross-appellants are Jason and Sherilyn Moore, represented by Jack A. Mosby. Did I say your name right, sir? Counsel, are there any preliminary matters prior to argument that you wish to address today?
No.
Very well. Mr. Curley, please.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Chris Curley, representing Patrick and Megan McLaughlin in this case. Even though the statute of frauds is not an issue that we are appealing, we are the respondent with respect to that issue, just because it is such a threshold issue in this case, admittedly, I thought I would lead off with a discussion of the statute of frauds if it's okay with Your Honors. So, with respect to the statute of frauds, let me begin by addressing the Tri-Court case, because I think we have to grapple with what that dicta in Tri-Court means and how the court should apply it. Of course, in Tri-Court, the court stated, albeit in dicta, that the policy of the statute of frauds is not furthered when someone is using the statute of frauds as a sword to escape the contract that they rule or that they regret. The court also made the comment about how the statute of frauds is supposed to, at least the policy behind the statute of frauds, is to protect people from having their interests in real property taken from them by perjury. And I would submit to the court that if there is any case where the dicta in Tri-Court should apply, it's this case, just because of the circumstances under which this contract was entered into by the parties. And the fact that the statute of frauds is being used here as a sword by the Moores to further their effort to get out of this contract. The statute of frauds is supposed to be used as a way to prevent fraud, not as a tool to promote, not necessarily fraud, but breach of contract. And how the court chooses to apply that dictate in Tri-Court, I frankly don't know. I know that in the recent 619 case, the plaintiff invited the court to apply that dictate in Tri-Court, and the court declined the invitation, to use the court's expression, for reasons that were discussed in the opinion. But those reasons don't exist here. There was an actual real estate purchase and sale agreement here that was signed all the way around. The parties did, by word and deed, honor that contract for 30 days or so. The statute of frauds wasn't even raised as a defense until Mr. Mosby wrote his letter in late November. So our position is that, with respect to Tri-Court, the statute of frauds should not even be available to the Moores as a defense.
My struggle with your argument, Mr. Curley, is the statute of frauds. It's set out in statute in the Idaho Code, and there's nothing in the code that says it only applies in this situation, not in this situation. And so I struggle with how this court can say we're only going to apply it sometimes.
You're absolutely right. I understand that completely. And the dicta in Tri-Court is what it is. And I'm just asking the court to apply it. The court is so inclined to apply it on the statute of frauds as it turns out. So, with respect to the statute of frauds, let me begin by discussing a word that appears in the cases that I think, in all due respect, has caused some lawyers and maybe even some judges to go down a primrose path. And the word term that is used in the cases is exactly, the description of the property in the documents has to exactly describe the property that's being conveyed. And I think that word implies a degree of precision or specificity that is not actually required by the law to examine the cases. And one of the things that the Tri-Court did was take a look at that very issue. Is that what does this word exactly mean as it appears in Ray v. Frazier and all of the other cases? And they actually looked at the dictionary the dictionary described exactly a strict conformance to a fact or condition. And then the Tri-Court Court says, well, that's not what our case is meaning by reference to exactly or use of that term. All we mean is that the writing must designate the Q, the I, and the quantity, the identity, and the boundaries. You have to be able to determine the quantity, identity, and boundaries of the property from the sales documents, or by reference to some extrinsic evidence to which those documents refer. That's what the word exactly means. It doesn't mean perfect. If it did, then I suppose someone could offer the statute of frauds as an excuse to get out of a contract when there was a transposition of the zip code or misspelling of the name.
Well, don't we have old deeds out there still that refer to the meander line of rivers and things that don't necessarily comport with the meets and bounds description?
Yeah, there are. There's a whole body of case law on the extent to which even a deed can refer to monuments or landmarks. Rivers, streams, ponds, who knows what else might constitute a landmark, a rock. But I suppose there could be a deed description of property that references and that measures the land as being extending 350 feet from the edge of the pond. And then another landmark is a rock. So, yes, there are cases indicating that even a deed can adequately describe property that refers to landmarks or monuments that are on property.
But we've rejected the reasonable certainty standard. And
yes.
So then what are you proposing defines exactly means? Because it's more than reasonable certainty.
Oh, definitely. Cases make that abundantly clear. Now, the documents do have to identify the quantity, identity, and boundaries. You have to be able to determine the quantity, identity, and boundaries of the property from the sales documents or documents to which the sales documents are. That's the test that's set forth in the cases, and that's the test that I'm offering today. That's the appropriate test for the court to apply. But our position, of course, is that the real estate purchase and sale agreement did identify the quantity, boundaries, and the identity of the property. 619 Crystal Springs Road, Sandpoint, Idaho, zip code, unit number 2, Twin Creeks Condominiums. I wonder how much more specific the document could have been short of an actual legal description.
So your clients weren't buying the garage? Because the garage isn't mentioned in that description.
Yeah, it isn't. The common areas are referred to as, are considered pertinences.
Well, the garage isn't a common area, is it? Because my understanding is the garage would have been something for your clients to use. It would not be a garage that all four unit owners could use.
I think the garage would still be considered an appurtenance to the condominium.
And where would we find that based on the description of unit number 2?
There's no Idaho case that says that common areas or garages are appurtenances. Cases that I'm aware of talk about things like water rights and easements being appurtenances to properties so that they don't even have to be mentioned.
No, but it's the garage is one example of where I look at Ray V. Frazier, I look at 616, I look at Geringer Capital, and we have repeatedly said that physical address is not enough. And that's one of the reasons why a physical address is not enough, is because just looking at the address on this agreement I don't even know there's a garage associated with that unit. When I, if I just read that physical address, I'm assuming it is a unit, and it's just the dwelling area of that unit. So that's where I struggle with how we can essentially reject the rule that a physical address isn't enough, which we've said repeatedly, and reach a different result here.
I think the answer is because for condominiums, areas like garages, they're shared parking lots.
But this garage wasn't shared. When I look at the photos, it looks like there were four separate garages that each had doors, and there was one dedicated for each unit. Am I misunderstanding? Was this any of the four unit owners could park in any of the four garages?
I don't know the answer to that, frankly. I think they probably be assigned, but there's nothing in the record with respect to that.
Okay.
But is the common area, Mr. Curley, assuming that the garages are part of the common area, whether they're assigned or not, is common area in a condominium situation like this an appurtenance?
Yes. And there is no Idaho law directly on points, but I did cite cases from other jurisdictions in the brief where the courts have held that common areas are appurtenances, and they don't even have to be mentioned in the deed in order to be conveyed along with the condominium unit. And I think there's a solid reason for that, and maybe the best reason is it's really difficult to know what any one condominium owner's share is, undivided share might be in the common areas at any given time. The appurtenances might include, what if there are only two owners in this building at the time? Your undivided share of the appurtenances might only be, instead of it being one quarter, it might be one half. So those sands are always shifting, and so it would be very difficult to even know what the appurtenances are. And that raises the question of if you have to refer to appurtenances in a sales document, what clarity does that reference actually provide to anyone when it's difficult to know what the appurtenances are at any one time, because maybe somebody's thinking about buying a new hot tub or a foosball table for the game room. And even this Idaho statute that that specifies how parties can legally describe a condominium just says appurtenances. So even in a deed, if you follow the statute exactly, you don't have to specify what the appurtenances are. Because there's really no way of knowing.
But if you follow the statute, you incorporate reference to the declaration.
True.
And you can identify the appurtenances by tracking down the declaration that's been incorporated into the description by reference.
Maybe. I mean, if the condominium was built in, let's just say, 1985, and it didn't have a deck on the back with a hot tub, you might go to the documents on file with the auditor's office and look at the actual dedication and see absolutely no reference to a deck.
No, but you would see reference to the common area land on which the deck is built, and then you could go to that area and see the deck and the hot tub. I mean, my point is nobody's going to be able to go out and take land that was previously dedicated as a unit and turn it into a common area and build something on it and not amend the declaration to reflect that this area that was a unit is now common area. So the declaration shows you what is common area, and then you can go view that area. That's the personal property that's selected to be placed in the common area, I don't know. I agree with you. You don't have to describe all the personal property, but I think reference to the declaration provides a complete description of what you're purchasing.
And Your Honor, I I'm not so sure about that, because if you took a common area such as the entryway, which is depicted in some of the photographs that were included, what if the homeowners get together and they decide, you know, we don't need this much space in the common area, let's carve up some of that common area and make a ski lot. And that's something that the condominium owners have done with respect to the common areas and improvements that would not necessarily be reflected if you went and examined the flat map or the dedication. I don't think it's quite that simple. I don't think you could necessarily go to the auditor's office, get a copy of some dedication that happened back in 1975, and in 2000 get an understanding of what all of the common areas might be. And that's why the concept of permanence is like.
Mr. Curley, I suspect Mr. Mosby is going to argue, and he can disagree with me when it's his turn, but just based on his briefing, I suspect he's going to argue that what was really required in the REPSA was a legal description. Is a legal description required for the purpose of the statute of frauds?
No court has ever held that. The state of Idaho, and my answer is no. You could have a description in documents that identifies the quantity, the identity, and the boundaries of the property and not have it be a legal description. Excuse me. And, so our position, of course, is that the description of the property in the real estate purchase and sale agreement itself satisfied the statute, because it did identify the quantity, the identity, and the boundaries of the property. There's another reason we think the statute frauds doesn't apply here, and that's because of the incorporation of the preliminary title. Just to refresh your honors on the dates, let me start with this. The respondents actually stated in their brief that there's no reference in the real estate purchase and sale agreement to a preliminary title commitment, and that's just not true. Paragraph 9 addresses title insurance, and it indicates that the buyer is going to furnish the preliminary title policy commitment. And with respect to the identity of the title company, the real estate purchase sale agreement states in paragraph 9b that it's to be determined, or TBE. So there is a specific reference to the preliminary title in the real estate purchase sale agreement. The identity of the title companies to be determined, and then the parties sign an addendum at a time when the preliminary title commitment had been issued. Pioneer Title actually issued the preliminary title commitment on the 17th of August, and the Moores signed the addendum to the real estate purchase agreement. Jason Moore signed on the 24th. Sherman Moore signed on the 26th. So when the Moore signed the addendum, the preliminary title commitment existed. The preliminary title commitment is referenced in the real estate purchase and sale agreement. And critically, the preliminary title commitment contained as an attachment a full legal description of the condominium. And the full legal description of the condominium followed the statute. Now, the Moores have argued that, well, you don't get to incorporate the preliminary title commitment because we never got it. Well, there's no requirement that I can find in Idaho law that says some document that's referenced in the sales documents has to be in possession of either of the parties. Indeed, in the Russell versus Russell case, the legal description of the property that was referenced was actually stapled to, I think, a copy of the real estate purchase and sale agreement and was contained in some file cabinet in either a lawyer's office or for the closing agent's office, and there was no indication, at least in the case law, that either of the parties had ever actually had physical possession of this document that provided the full legal description of the property. So, again, just to recap, we have a specific reference to the preliminary title commitment in the real estate purchase agreement. Then the preliminary title insurance is issued. It contains a full legal description of the property. And then the Moores signed the addendum after the preliminary title commitment was issued. And so I think that the preliminary title commitment satisfies the requirement for incorporation of records. With the complete legal description of the property attached, it satisfies the statute of frauds.
Let's go back to the garage for just a minute. I'm looking at one of the photographs. It's not clear to me if it's a photograph or if it's like on realtor.com or what exactly I'm looking at here, but there's four garages.
Yes.
And it looks like there's a single entrance, that all dwellers would use to go to their units. Is that right?
I think that's correct.
Okay. So is there any interior access to these garages? And what I mean is it evident from inside the building which garage goes to which unit?
I think the answer to that is no, just because of the physical location of the garage relative to the units. The garage is on street level, the ground level, which you would expect.
Right.
You walk into the entryway of the building, and two of the condominiums are located, I'll just say downstairs, down a set of stairs, and the other two condominiums are located down a set of stairs. So I think the answer is no. I think entrance from the garage is into a common area, and that's where people, and then from there, people go to their individual units. And Back to the issue of the garage, frankly, I didn't quite expect that to come up today, but I'm wondering how often in a sales transaction, if someone, let's just say someone agrees to, the sales document said, I offer to sell you my house at 3036 Circle Place in Spokane, Washington, and the land beneath it. And my house has an attached garage. But I don't specifically say that in my description of the property. It just says house. It isn't a garage.
Well, yeah, but when you're selling someone a house, usually the transaction refers to the boundaries of the land and everything within it. It doesn't mention every dwelling, every chicken coop, everything on the property.
It does not, Your Honor, but I'm just following this issue with respect to the garage.
But let me tell you why I ask, and I think it's an intriguing issue, because, I mean, when I look at the purchase and sale agreement and I see unit number two, when I think of that, I'm like, okay, we seem to be identifying it, seems to be a quantity, it's going to be one unit, but then we have four garages in this single building, and if the garages don't, like if I had a door between my unit and the garage, okay, yeah, no question about which garage belongs to me. But as I look at this photograph, I was questioning, how would it be that the people on the second floor would access these garages? You know, I'm trying to, and so I'm like, is number two enough where we don't know whose garage? I don't know which garage is number two. I mean, is there some way to know which garage is number two?
I don't know as I stand here. I don't know if there are numbers above the garage doors that associate the garages with a particular unit. I just don't know the answer. However, back to my example of how I think a garage is so intimately associated with a piece of property that it's not necessary to separately describe the garage. What I was trying to say, perhaps inarticulately, just was that I don't think it's necessary if the property documents describe a building at a specific address, and let's just say the land beneath the building. So it's like. Right.
But condominiums are different than selling regular real estate. Condominium usually exists in a shared vertical location with other units. And so to distinguish unit two from unit three and the things that are connected to unit two, wouldn't that require a little more detail than just standard one house and a garage on one lot?
Your Honor, perhaps, but I still think that the garage would be considered an appurtenance and should be considered an appurtenance, so that it does not have to be specifically mentioned.
Are the declarations of the Twin Creeks condominium in the record?
No.
It seems like that would answer a lot of questions.
Perhaps, but because the declarations were not specifically referenced in REPSA, admittedly, those declarations were never submitted to the court below.
You know, in searching the record, trying to find those declarations, I found multiple references to the Unit 2 of the Twin Creeks condominium according to the declarations thereof. I'm a little shocked to find out the declarations never made it into the record.
Are they attached to the preliminary title commitment?
I don't believe so.
I looked there. And it seems to me that we just recently had a case involving a document that's referenced in a deed. And it just seems to me typically those find their way into the record in most cases.
Well, again, our position is that because the preliminary title commitment specifically referenced, attached as an exhibit, the full legal description, that was enough to identify the property. Now you have something that you can use, go to the county and an auditor's office and look it up if you feel that's necessary. I only have 55 seconds left, so let me just conclude my remarks by saying I think the document satisfied the statute of frauds here. We're dealing with lay people who are trying to consummate a transaction, and I think it would be unreasonable for the court to impose upon lay people a degree of precision with respect to the identity or description of the property. It's not necessary. And I haven't talked about partial performance here, and again, I'm running out of time, but I think partial performance would be another reason to find that this contract was valid or enforceable, just because of all of the things that both parties did for about a month or so in full recognition of and in contemplation of the contract. And
what do you think the most salient examples are?
Well, I'll just go down the list. The real estate purchase and sale agreement required the Glaufins to line up finance and everything they were supposed to do that. The real estate purchase and sale agreement required the Glaufins to procure preliminary title insurance. They did that. The real estate purchase and sale agreement required the parties to cooperate with respect to scheduling an inspection. They did that. So those are three things that were specifically referenced in the documents that the parties did before that fateful September 6th. Yeah. One comment about the board's reliance on the Kessler versus Pruitt case. Kessler versus Pruitt is significant, I think, because the court cited with approval the Spallingberg versus First National Bank case. And I think that's probably the best example of the degree of specificity that's required in contract documents to identify a piece of property. Property at issue in the Spallingberg case was the side room in our bank. And the reference to the side room in our bank was on the letterhead of the First National Bank located in Montpelier. And the court said that that's sufficient for purposes of the statute of frauds to identify the property at issue. We've got a discrete building, one of a kind, located in a particular town, and the reference was to a side room in the bank. If that is enough to satisfy the statute of frauds, I don't understand how a reference to a building at a specific state address and a specific unit or room within that building isn't enough. You know, the 619 case is pretty recent, and I think the facts of that case are useful because I think they help us discuss this issue. In the 619 case, there was this purchase and sale agreement, or asset purchase agreement, that referred to business premises. And then there was an attached and incorporated asset list that identified a bunch of personal property that was in various locations on the property. And the court held that that wasn't enough because it was impossible to tell from the documents exactly what portion of the premises were being leased. And quote the court's language from that case because I think it illustrates the degree of specificity that's required. After discussing what the asset purchase agreement and the asset list didn't say, the court said, quote, even when the physical address is considered alongside the room's headings mentioned in the asset list, nothing in the writings identifies the mentioned rooms as being within any particular location, buildings, or otherwise in the physical address. Nothing in the writings identifies the mentioned rooms as being within any particular location, buildings, or otherwise in the physical address. Earlier in the case, the court talked about how the lessee in that case had actually occupied a portion of the building that was referred to as room 100. Now, if those documents are sweet ones.
Sir, I'm sorry, but you're out of time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Justices. I'm Jack Mosby, attorney for respondents, cross appellants Jason and Sherilyn Moore, who are with us today. I'd like to first start just by answering a few points that I heard during Mr. Curley's argument. First of all, as to answer the question, Justice, as to what the standard is that should be applied, I think the Idaho case law already provides it. If it's not described, it is not conveyed. That's basically what the Benton Trust versus McCarty case stands for.
Well, but the RECSA isn't a conveyancing document, is it?
It is not, Justice. And that's another point I wanted to arrive at, was that the case law that this court has, whether it's under Idaho Code 9-505 subsection 4 for a contract for the sale of real property, or whether it's under 9-503 for an instrument conveying real property, both have been construed under the same tests. If you look back to the McCarty case or Garner versus Farchi, both of these statutes that have been analyzed in the same cases, citing the same standard, that it must be exact. But what does that mean?
Right.
I think in Benton Trust versus McCarty, I think in that case it was very clear. Under City of Kellogg, identification of landmarks can be sufficient to convey the land directly beneath the landmark. But if the intent is to convey more than just what is directly beneath the landmark, it is ambiguous and inadequate. So that means it must exactly describe, as my colleague indicated, the quantity, identity, and boundaries of what is to be conveyed. If it doesn't do that, it is inadequate.
So what's inadequate about the description in the REPSA in this case?
It does not identify the boundaries of what is to be conveyed.
And what is different in that regard in the legal description?
The incorporation of an instrument that presumably would describe what goes with it. We know from the testimony offered by Ms. Sherilyn Moore in Volume 2 of the rec of the transcript that the what is going along with this, what real property, what land is actually conveyed, is a shared interest in the entire parcel on which the building exists. So there's the parking lots, there's the shared ownership in the building itself, there's the garage, there's a game room beyond, and it, I think you can see the entry door to the game room and some of the exhibits to the court trial. All of these things are outside of the unit. They're not just appurtenances, as my colleague described. As he indicated, there isn't any Idaho case law that says that, and his examples are easements or water rights. We're talking about land occupying a physical space on the ground. That has to be described. The boundaries have to be set somewhere. When a person, for example, Gray versus Fraser, where we go to the actual address where the property is located, a person goes to the address, there's no indication as to how big is the property on which this land, this unit is located. What rights are accompanying this property? There's no way to refer to unit, or I'll get to that in a second, 419 Crystal Springs Road, number 2, an address that says where the property is, and identify, okay, I'm looking for the property legally described as Twin Creeks Condos. How do I know where that is when I see only one building when I arrive, and I don't know how large is the property on which it is located? It's, at the very least, extremely ambiguous. So, to get to the thrust of the answer to the question, I think exactly means that if anything is to be conveyed that is outside of the actual land, the actual physical area described, that's not good enough.
Is the legal description in this case then good enough, where it says Unit 2 of Twin Creeks Condominium according to the declaration thereof, and then it has the instrument number and so forth, county, state, together with the pertinent interests?
Justice, I think that question is, it's a hard one to answer in this case because we don't have that declaration in the record, as was already asked while my colleague was arguing. That instrument doesn't appear in the record. So we don't even know if that record number is accurately describing the condominium declaration applicable. Assuming that it does describe the condominium declaration that is recorded in Bonner County, and assuming that that instrument is like a typical declaration setting forth what each condominium unit entails, then it probably is sufficient, but we don't know that.
But isn't that something, I mean, that's a description, I think, in the preliminary title commitment. So if we conclude the preliminary title commitment is incorporated by reference, it appears that description would be sufficient on its face. And to the extent your client wants to argue it's not, isn't it your client's obligation to come forward and say that instrument number is a faulty reference?
I agree, Justice Zahn. And I think Judge Buchanan made a finding that that description does, in fact, describe the subject parcel that the Moores actually own, that the description in the title commitment is the description of that parcel. But it's not incorporated by reference. The reference that has to be incorporated, it has to be specific. And as Judge Buchanan properly decided at the court trial, it didn't exist at the time that the REPSA was signed by either of the parties. It didn't exist at the time that the McLaughlins signed the addendum. They signed it on the 14th. The instrument that you're referring to, the title commitment, was created on the 17th. That's why it's dated upon the 17th. So at the time one of the parties signed it, and the addendum also doesn't speak to the actual title commitment, at the time the instrument came into existence, it was not referenced specifically by any party. In the REPSA, that speaks to that a title commitment would be at some point in the future obtained as part of this transaction, there wasn't even a title company identified. in that instrument. So where this was even going to come from wasn't available to the Moores. They have nowhere to even look to go find this title commitment, much less actually have it.
Well, it was available when they signed the addendum. You said that the title commitment itself was, didn't you say it was dated the 17th?
Yes, Justice.
And your clients signed the addendum on the 24th and 26th or something like that?
Yes. It was not available to the Moores because there was no indication that it ever existed at the time that they signed it. They may have known where the title company was supposed to be, but there was no indication reading the addendum that this title commitment had come into existence at the time. It wasn't referenced in the addendum. It was only obliquely referenced in the REPSA itself that at some point in the future this would be done. It's just like in Garner versus Barchi with the reference that a survey would be done in the future. That can't be incorporated. Judge Buchanan found or came to that conclusion, and I think the facts support that conclusion very clearly. So we have the REPSA and the addendum. That's the party's agreement. Also, just to quickly address Spongberg, that case was before Ray, before the standard became exact as opposed to reasonable certainty. So that case is an apposite to this argument.
I want to talk about the garage for a minute. So the photos indicate, am I correct that the unit number two is one of the lower units in the building, correct?
Yes, just
okay.
Brody.
And is there a door, and does the record show it? Is there a door between that unit and a garage?
There is not. In the volume two of the record, there are two places where, or excuse me, the transcript, there are two places where that evidence is contained. In the examination of Ms. McLaughlin, that's at pages 32 to 37, where she's talking about the various other portions of the property that are not part of the unit, but the other things that she really liked about the property. And then I think it was on page 96 through, something around page 96, where Ms. Moore was providing her testimony about what this entails. And the garage, as my colleague, I believe, stated, is entered through the common area accessway before you get into units. Does that answer your question, Mrs.?
Yes, thank you.
The REPSA contains an integration clause. That's the merger provision. That's at paragraph 39 of the agreement on page 6. So we know, based on that merger clause and the findings of fact that Judge Buchanan arrived at the court trial, and so the original court trial, and by the existence of these two instruments, that the agreement is memorialized by the REPSA and the addendum. That's the agreement. It's not the title commitment. It's not anything else. It's not, and as my colleague mentioned, it's not based on the actual declaration of the condominium, because that was never, first of all, made part of the record, but second of all, the reason it wasn't, as he said, is because it wasn't referenced in the REPSA.
Can I ask you a question that's been bothering me about this case as I think about it? This is an unusual case in that it's a seller's remorse case, could be perceived as such anyway, as opposed to a buyer's remorse type of case. And I'm just wondering where the seller is the one responsible typically for putting together the REPSA and everything. If we follow your argument, do we create a perverse incentive for sellers to be imprecise in describing their property so that they can get out of a deal? Like this one by saying, oh, the legal prescription we put in there wasn't precise enough?
Justice Moore, I think that question tees up something else I wanted to state in response to something my colleague indicated at the end of his argument, and that speaks to what is required of a layperson with respect to the statute of frauds. There is no lesser degree of responsibility for laypeople in what statute of frauds is applicable or what is required for the degree of specificity. Indeed, in Idaho, self-represented litigants are held to the same standard as those who are represented. I think it's consistent with that, that a layperson is, and I don't know the citation, I apologize, but a layperson is required to know the law. And the law in this state is that the description must be exact.
Right, but here the description was, I think we're dealing with two laypeople here. And there's a possibility that one of them may be taking advantage of their mistake to oppress another layperson. So I'm not sure that layperson analysis gets us anywhere. again, to my question, does this create a perverse incentive for buyers to be imprecise in legal descriptions so they can back out of a deal anytime they want? Excuse me, not buyers, sellers to use an imprecise description so they can back out of this anytime they want?
I don't think so, because I think that sword swings both ways. I think that whether it's the buyer or the seller, if either party can void the transaction by crafting an improper legal description, then the sellers would be out of their earnest money.
But in reality, typically it's the seller that provides the legal description, not the buyer, correct?
I would think it would be. I don't think I'm qualified to opine on what is generally so, but
I'll concede that there are many instances perhaps where a buyer would provide the legal description, but the vast majority of the time when a seller's selling a condo, selling a home, they're the ones that put together the transaction, aren't they? They're the ones that supply the legal descriptions, whether there's an agent involved or not.
I would think so, Justice Mueller. I also think that ultimately when a transaction closes, it is merged with the deed. And the deed, the legal description that is supplied for the deed is often obtained during the middle of the transaction. What you see in these typical real estate purchase and sale agreements is usually an abbreviated legal description. Something more simple prepared by the agent, not exactly how it appears in the deed that is ultimately used, which arrives as the title commitment. So I think that's getting away from the point. I think there certainly are opportunities where a seller who is sophisticated and knows that what's required and specifically decides I'm not going to put that in a description, perhaps they could perceive a benefit where they could void it if they want to.
But taking Justice Mueller's point and applying it to the facts of this case, who drafted the legal description?
Mr. McLaughlin, the buyer, drafted the description in this case. In the testimony at trial, we're asking about where the Twin Creeks condos came from. That's how the REPSA legally describes the property. It came from the sign on the outside of the building. That's where it came from. And that comes from the trial testimony cited in the briefing. Does that answer your question, Justice?
Yeah. I guess my concern is just I'm thinking about the result of our ruling and whether or not it actually applies to the facts of what happened here or not. If the result of our ruling is that the seller has just been given a nice little loophole to get out of any real estate transaction they later regret.
Thank you, Justice Mueller. I think that speaks to the tricorp dicta that my colleague let off his argument with, and I think that's been addressed multiple times before this court, most recently in the Capital versus Tonton case. I think that even to your point, Justice Zahn, that's not the law of this state, and I think that the statute, the code, doesn't actually state that, and so for this court to decide now that the code applies some exception to the statute of frauds that doesn't exist there, I think that would be improper. It doesn't appear in the statute. That would be stepping into the realm of the legislature. Now, the REPSA contains some other salient terms that I'd like to highlight, and they're highlighted in the briefing as well. In big, bold, capital letters, in a standalone paragraph all by itself, it are the words, time is of the essence in this agreement. That's paragraph 40. That's very important as it was briefed both at the lower court level and as it's contained in the briefing before this court. Also, there's an attorney's fee shifting provision for the prevailing party, whether initiating or defending an action. That's paragraph 29. And the closing date, the only date that was ever in a written agreement, is January 5th, and that's on paragraph 36. Ultimately, transaction didn't close. The McLaughlins didn't tender the full purchase price at the closing.
But that's not why the transaction didn't close, is it?
I don't think that conclusion has been arrived at.
Well, your clients had no intention of closing. They didn't show up at the closing. They didn't sign any deeds, right?
No, they did not, Justice.
Okay. And they had no intention of closing. So let's talk about tender in light of that. I understand your argument about time is of the essence, but even when you're going to the more modern Kessler case, and I realize that given the dates, they're probably different parties. It says time is of the essence. Certain things have to happen unless it's futile. That's the very next sentence. So address that, if you will. How would it not be futile for the lender to have wired the funds over when the Moores weren't even there and were not going to sign the deed?
I believe that the order denying the motion for reconsideration speaks volumes as to that analysis. That's the district court after Judge Jensen took over. There's a distinction, and again, we're dealing with an abuse of discretion standard. There's a distinction between futility and a high degree of unlikelihood. In this case, distinguished from Kessler versus Tortoise, the subsequent Kessler case, that case involved impossibility. It could not be done. In this case, that was not so.
Well, hold on. I thought there was testimony at the court trial by a representative of the lender saying they weren't going to transmit their money to the title company without a signed agreement in hand. Was that testimony at the hearing?
Justice, I'm not sure what you're referring to. The lender may not have been willing to. I was referring to from the Moores' perspective. The Moores, there was only possibility on the Moores' side where there was.
My point is the McLaughlins admitted testimony that they had a lender lined up ready to send the money to the title company. They just needed, a lender needed, a signed contract, which makes sense. Why would a lender send a ton of money to a title company that's going to lock it up in a trust and not just give it back? So why would a lender do that without a signed contract? When we talk about impossibility, though, I tend to view the facts as your clients made performance impossible because they refused. But separate and apart from futility, they refused to sign the contract. And the lender was not going to fund this without something in exchange. And so how did your clients not render performance impossible by refusing to sign the contract that was the basis for the loan?
Tender of the purchase price is not dependent upon a loan. It's still the burden of the buyers to submit the purchase price at closing, regardless of whether they're acquiring it through a loan or not.
And they were ready, willing, and able, but for your client's failure to sign the contract, your client's failure to show up at closing at all.
And on top of that, the REPSA contemplated financing.
It surely did, Justice Meyer. But even still, the tender of the purchase price under Pruitt in a time of the essence contract is actual tender. Ready, willing, and able is not the standard, unless there's futility. However, the futility is not futility of if they tender the money, then the transaction still cannot close.
So let me ask this a different way, then. If the appellants had shown up at the closing, cash in hand, said, here you go, paid in full, is there any chance it would have closed?
There is a chance.
Are we talking about a dumb and dumber one in a million chance, or are we talking about something that there was any likelihood that would happen?
I don't know the percentage, Justice Mueller. I think it's highly unlikely.
So is it less than one in a million?
I don't know.
And your clients had no intention of closing, did they?
No, they didn't.
Okay.
And I think that's contained in the records, that they did not intend to close. That's abundantly clear. The facts have been found that there was no intention. But that's not the standard. Intent, willingness, it's whether it was possible, whether it was futile. And
when they didn't show up to closing at all, they refused to sign the documents. They said, we're not going to show up, we're not going to sign the documents. I'm struggling to understand how tender was not futile or your clients rendered it impossible, because what lender is going to transmit a bunch of money to a title company with no signed contract in hand?
The futility is if we perform, and if the McLaughlins were to have tendered the purchase price, is that a futile act, tendering the purchase price, or because, as in Tortoise, the seller could not convey marketable title to the property? That's the difference. Is the act of performance a futile act versus did one party render the other's ability to perform impossible? Those are two different legal analyses. And in this case, the issue is if the McLaughlins were to have tendered the purchase price, they would have fully performed. which is what Pruitt required, whereas in Tortoise, let's say, for example, if the Moors didn't have marketable title and they told the McLaughlins, we cannot perform, that's what it would have made it very similar to the analysis in Kessler versus Tortoise. It would have been an impossibility. It would have been a futility.
I guess I'm struggling with trying to draw a distinction between we cannot perform and under no circumstances will we perform. I'm not seeing a distinction there when it comes to futility.
Notwithstanding, I think Judge Jensen had the opportunity to waive her legal options here, and she could still require it. It's an abuse of discretion standard.
It's an abuse of discretion standard, but she's still required to follow the law applicable to her decision, which expressly incorporates you don't have to tender if it's impossible or futile. And I did not see her struggle or address or distinguish that case law at all.
I believe she did when she stated that it would not have been futile. The Moors could still have performed. If the money had been tendered, the Moors could have performed and closed the sale. It would not be necessarily futile.
And my struggle is you just admitted not that long ago that the evidence in the record is your clients had made clear they had no intention of performing. Moreover, they didn't show up to closing. So to the extent the district court made a factual finding that they still could have performed, I'm struggling to see substantial competent evidence in the record to support that.
I understand, Justice Sun. Notwithstanding, I think that the briefing speaks for the remainder of that argument that ultimately it was one of the options, and just Judge Jensen interpreted futility as absolute futility, not as a high degree of unlikelihood, even based on a statement that it was that the Moors did not intend to perform. And I think that's about as good as a record is going to reflect. Regarding this statute of frauds, I think I've already indicated what description I believe is required to satisfy the statute. But let's look at what the description actually states. Just quoting it. Commonly known as 419 Crystal Springs Road, number 2, City of Sandpoint, County, Idaho, zip 8364, legally described as Twin Creeks Condos.
Is there any question that number 2 is the designation of that unit on the declaration that's recorded?
Thank you for the question, Justice Brody. That was the next point I was going to make. There is nothing in the REPSA that identifies that as a unit number. And that is one of the ambiguities that is very similar to your decision in the, I believe, the 616 case regarding the, we don't know which combination is applicable here. Is that a unit number? Is it a lot number, a block number? Or is it a building number? We don't know. It's in the address, too. It's not in the legal description. So it's just telling us where the property is located, not what it is. It doesn't say unit number. It has just the number symbol, the hashtag, and then the number 2. Doesn't say unit.
Was there any likelihood to be confused with any other unit or hashtagged description in the condominium area?
As the facts are on the ground, I don't know that that would be the case, but the legal description says Twin Creeks Condos, plural. So if we're referring to Twin Creeks Condos, I'm thinking multiple, and this is number 2, so I'm thinking if I show up, I'm looking around for possibly building number 2, or maybe it's unit number 2 in each of the Twin Creeks Condos.
Is there more than one Twin Creeks condominiums?
Or condominium? So, Mrs. Meyer. But that's extrinsic evidence, and that's not admissible to supply a resolution to an ambiguity that is otherwise apparent on the face of a legal description in a purchase and sale agreement.
Well, but I'm looking at the Idaho Condominium Property Act 55-1526. Every deed, contract of sale, may legally describe a condominium by its identifying number, symbol, name, or other identification or designation as shown on the plat of record or as shown in the declaration. And then when I read the legal description that was on the schedule attached to the preliminary title report, I mean, the only real difference between the legal description or the property description that's in the REPSA and the one that's in the title report is the incorporation of the declaration. It says as shown on, and it's got the number in this declaration. And so I guess my question is under 55.15.26, which says every such description shall be deemed good and sufficient for all purposes, is number two plus the reference to the Twin Creeks condominiums, is that enough under this statute? Or do you have to incorporate the recording instrument number?
I believe you have to incorporate the instrument number. The key language in that statute, I believe it says, as shown on the ladder of record or as shown in the declaration. In this case, we don't even know there is one.
There is an instrument number, though. Not in the RIPSA, but...
In the title commitment, the legal description does supply an instrument number.
Yeah.
Presumably that refers to a declaration. Presumably that contains a legal description. The facts just aren't so in this case.
It's not in the record.
It's not. We don't know. And that's exactly the issue here. If that were enough, if that were the standard, then I'm sure that declaration, that instrument, would have been incorporated here. But it's not. And I think that speaks volumes. If you just look back at the precedent from this court, going back over 100 years, you go to Allen versus Kitchen, extrinsic evidence is not admissible to supply these terms unless it's specifically referenced in the instrument.
But is that a fair inference? You're asking us to infer because it wasn't submitted. It must have been bad news for the appellant. Couldn't we easily assume that and infer that it might have been bad news for your client? That's why you didn't introduce it into the record? Bottom line is nobody introduced it to the record.
No one introduced it to the record, and my clients are the defendants. They were trying to make a case.
I get that you're saying it wasn't your duty to do so. That's fair. But I'm saying asking us to infer that it would be adverse, is that fair? Because I suspect if it would have been helpful to you, you would have introduced it.
Presumably so, Justice Mueller.
Before you run out of time, is it your position that in order for reps that have a proper to properly describe the property, it has to contain the legal description?
No, Justice Meyer. I think the common practice nowadays is an abbreviated legal, that whether you're a realtor or an attorney or someone who works at the county, we're familiar with interpreting abbreviated legal descriptions. And sometimes, I mean, there are the cases that refer to tax numbers, if the tax number refers to an actual description in the assessments for that tax, applicable to that tax number or parcel number, whatever, however it's designated, that could be sufficient. Similarly, an actual meets and bounds description would be. Or, getting back to the, kind of as Justice Zahn was indicating, regarding the lack of the instrument by reference in the legal description under the Condominium Act, I think a reference to the instrument would be sufficient.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Your time is now complete. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments today. This matter is under advisement. We will be in recess until tomorrow at 8:58.
All rise, please.